Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours. Hello, friends, and welcome to Issue 20 of Protecting Project Pulp, the podcast that shakes the highest and most dangerous branches of the great literature tree, knocking loose the sweet, pulpy fruit that we then bake into a sumptuous pie so we can serve up a slice of delicious pulp fiction to you each week. I'm your apparently very hungry host and literary confectioner, Dave Robison. And oh, dear listeners, such dark deliciousness we have for you this episode. This tale is like a chunk of brandied dark chocolate with a salted caramel center that will consume your soul and hurl it into the cold, dark void of hellish eternity. My aunt used to make a plate of that for us each holiday. We'd take turns trying to invoke the lost spirits of our cousins and uncles, racing to see who could reinvest them into mortal flesh first. Good times. Today, we offer up a tale that dances in the shadows of one of the most iconic mythologies of the pulp fiction era, the Cthulhu mythos. Oh yes, our tale is none other than The Fane of the Black Pharaoh by Robert Bloch, first dragged into the light of day in Weird Tales back in December of 1937. Now, if you're a Cthulhu purist and bristle at the notion of some name other than Lovecraft being associated with that dark tentacled deity, just cool your jets. Lovecraft was Bloch's mentor and one of the first people to encourage Bloch to pursue his dark gifts at spinning tales. Apparently, the encouragement took, for Bloch went on to write literally hundreds of short stories and over 30 novels. While he started his career emulating Lovecraft's flavor of cosmic horror, Bloch ultimately found his home writing crime stories and psychological horror, including the novel Psycho, later elevated to cinematic glory by Alfred Hitchcock. Bloch's fiction earned him a Hugo Award, as well as a Bram Stoker and a World Fantasy Award. Among the many organizations that enjoyed his affiliation are the Mystery Writers of America, where he served a term as president, the Science Fiction Writers of America, the Writers Guild, and the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Science. Did I neglect to mention he was a prolific screenwriter as well? Shame on me. This week, our tale is luxuriously narrated by the eloquent and evocative Nick Cam. Nick is an actor, drummer, do-it-yourself filmmaker, dog walker, and potential writer, so he keeps saying, from England. Throughout his acting career, he has been resoundingly successful in his failure to hit the big time, although he is occasionally on TV, which pays for the dog's food. An intriguing informational factoid, Nick was recently revealed as the real radio renegade, which basically involves being chased around the country by thousands of people who would win a great deal of money if they found him. It's complicated. Nick is seriously keen to crack the professional voice acting nut and would welcome any feedback and, indeed, any ridiculously well-paid job offers. And by ridiculously well-paid, he means the price of a tin of above-average dog food. He can be contacted on Twitter at NickCam1. We'd refer you to his website, but apparently the meager technical prowess required to erect such an elementary tool of modern communication continues to elude him. We consider ourselves fortunate indeed that he absolutely adores what the District of Wonders team are doing, and we're looking forward to hearing his resonant tones bringing life to future tales. So, it's time to go. No, it's all right. Trust me. This is everything you've been striving to achieve your entire life. The curtain of time and mystery that has shrouded these secrets for so long will finally be drawn aside, and you will be the first to perceive them. Just follow me.
Fane of the Black Pharaoh by Robert Bloch. Terrible was the fame of Nephron Carr, and more terrible still was the destiny that Captain Carteret read on the walls of the red-litten underground corridors. "Liar," said Captain Carteret. The dark man did not move, but beneath the shadows of his burnous, a scowl slithered across a contorted countenance. But when he stepped forward into the lamplight, he smiled.
"That is a harsh epithet, effendi," purred the dark man.
Captain Carteret stared at his midnight visitor with quizzical appraisal. "A deserved one, I think," he observed. "Consider the facts. You come to my door at midnight, uninvited and unknown. You tell me some long rigmarole about secret vaults below Cairo, and then, voluntarily, offer to lead me there."
"That is correct," assented the Arab, blandly.
He met the glance of the scholarly captain calmly. "Why should you do this?" pursued Carteret. "If your story is true, and you do possess so manifestly absurd a secret, why should you come to me? Why not claim the glory of discovery yourself?"
"I told you, effendi," said the Arab, "that it is against the law of our brotherhood. It is not written that I should do so. And knowing of your interest in these things, I came to offer you the privilege."
"You came to pump me for my information. No doubt that's what you mean," retorted the captain acidly. "You beggars have some devilishly clever ways of getting underground information, don't you? So far as I know, you're here to find out how much I've already learned, so that you and your fanatic thugs can knife me if I know too much."
"Ah,"
the dark stranger suddenly leaned forward and peered into the white man's face.
"Then you admit that what I tell you is not wholly strange. You do know something of this place already?"
"Suppose I do," said the captain, unflinching. "That doesn't prove that you're a philanthropic guide to what I'm seeking. More likely, you want to pump me, as I said, then dispose of me and get the goods for yourself. No, your story is too thin. Why, you haven't even told me your name."
"My name," the Arab smiled, "that does not matter. What does matter is your distrust of me. But since you have admitted at last that you do know about the crypt of Nephren Carr, perhaps I can show you something that may prove my own knowledge."
He thrust a lean hand under his robe and drew forth a curious object of dull black metal. This he flung casually along the table, so that it lay in a fan of lamplight. Captain Carteret bent forward and peered at this queer metallic thing. His thin, usually pale face now glowed with unconcealed excitement. He grasped the black object with twitching fingers.
"The seal of Nephren Carr," he whispered.
When he raised his eyes to the inscrutable Arabs once more, they shone with mingled incredulity and belief.
"It's true, then, what you say," the captain breathed. "You could obtain this only from the secret place, the place of the blind apes, where Nephren Carr bindeth up the threads of truth."
The smiling Arab finished the quotation for him.
"You, too, have read the Necronomicon, then?"
Carteret looked stunned.
"But There are only 6 complete versions, and I thought the nearest was in the British Museum.
The Arab's smile broadened.
My fellow countrymen, Al-Hazred left many legacies among his own people, he said softly. There is wisdom available to all who know where to seek it.
For a moment there was silence in the room. Carteret glanced at the black seal, and the Arab scrutinized him in turn. The thoughts of both were far away. At last, the thin, elderly white man looked up with a quick grimace of determination.
"I believe your story," he said. "Lead me."
The Arab, with a satisfied shrug, took a chair unbidden at the side of his host. From that moment he assumed complete psychic mastery of the situation.
"First, you must tell me what you know," he commanded. "Then I shall reveal the rest."
Carteret, unconscious of the other's dominance, complied. He told the stranger his story in an abstracted manner, while his eyes never swerved from the cryptic black amulet on the table. It was almost as though he were hypnotized by the queer talisman. The Arab said nothing, though there was a gay gloating in his fanatical eyes. Carteret spoke of his youth, of his wartime service in Egypt and subsequent station in Mesopotamia. It was here that the captain had first become interested in archaeology and the shadowy realms of the occult which surrounded. From the vast desert of Arabia had come intriguing tales as old as time, furtive fables of mystic Irem, city of the ancient dread, and the lost legends of vanished empires. He had spoken to the dreaming dervishes whose hashish visions revealed secrets of forgotten days, and had explored certain reputedly ghoul-ridden tombs and burrows in the ruins of an older Damascus than recorded history knows. In time, his retirement had brought him to Egypt. Here, in Cairo, there was access to still more secret lore. Egypt, land of lurid curses and lost kings, has ever harbored mad myths in its age-old shadows. Carteret had learned of priests and pharaohs, of olden oracles, forgotten sphinxes, fabulous pyramids, titanic tombs. Civilization was but a cobweb surface upon the sleeping face of eternal mystery. Here, beneath the inscrutable shadows of the pyramids, the old gods still stalked in the old ways. The ghosts of Set, Ra, Osiris, and Bubastis lurked in desert ways. Horus, Isis, and Sebek yet dwelt in the ruins of Thebes and Memphis, or bided in the crumbling tombs below the Valley of the Kings. Nowhere had the past survived as it did in ageless Egypt. With every mummy, the Egyptologists uncovered a curse, the solving of each ancient secret merely uncovered a deeper, more perplexing riddle. Who built the pylons of the temples? Why did the old kings rear the pyramids? How did they work such marvels? Were their curses potent still? Where vanished the priests of Egypt? These and a thousand other unanswered questions intrigued the mind of Captain Carteret. In his newfound leisure he read and studied, talked with scientists and savants. Ever the quest of primal knowledge beckoned him on to blacker brinks. He could slake his thirsty soul only in stranger secrets, more dangerous discoveries. Many of the reputable authorities he knew were open in their confessed opinion that it was not well for meddlers to pry too deeply beneath the surface. Curses had come true with puzzling promptness, and warning prophecies had been fulfilled with a vengeance. It was not good to profane the shrines of the old dark gods who still dwelt within the land. But the terrible lure of the forgotten and the forbidden was a pulsing virus in Carteret's blood. When he heard the legend of Nefrenkar, he naturally investigated. Nefrenkar, according to authoritative knowledge, was merely a mythical figure. He was purported to have been a pharaoh of no known dynasty, a priestly usurper of the throne. The most common fables placed his reign in almost biblical times. He was said to have been the last and greatest of that Egyptian cult of priest sorcerers who for a time transformed the recognized religions into a dark and terrible thing. This cult, led by the arch-hierophants of Bubastis, Anubis, and Sebek, viewed their gods as the representatives of actual hidden beings, monstrous beastmen who shambled on Earth in primal days. They accorded worship to the Elder One who is known to myth as Nyarlathotep, the Mighty Messenger. This abominable deity was said to confer wizards' powers upon receiving human sacrifices, and while the evil priests reigned supreme, they temporarily transformed the religion of Egypt into a bloody shambles. With anthropomancy and necrophilism, they sought terrible boons from their demons. The tale goes that Netherenkar, on the throne, renounced all religions save that of Nyarlathotep. He sought the power of prophecy and built temples to the blind ape of truth. His utterly atrocious sacrifices at length provoked a revolt, and it is said that the infamous pharaoh was at last dethroned. According to this account, the new ruler and his people immediately destroyed all vestiges of the former reign, demolished all temples and idols of Nyarlathotep, and drove out the wicked priests who prostituted their faith to the carnivorous Bubastis, Anubis, and Sebek. The Book of the Dead was then amended so that all references to the pharaoh Nefrenkar and his accursed cults were deleted. Thus, argues the legend, the furtive faith was lost to reputable history. As to Nefrenkar himself, a strange account is given of his end. The story ran that the dethroned pharaoh fled to a spot adjacent to what is now the modern city of Cairo. Here it was his intention to embark with his remaining followers for a westward isle. Historians believe that this isle was Britain, where some of the fleeing priests of Bubastis actually settled. But the pharaoh was attacked and surrounded, his escape blocked. It was then that he had constructed a secret underground tomb, in which he caused himself and his followers to be interred alive. With him, in this vivisepulchre, he took all his treasures and magical secrets, so that nothing would remain for the enemies to profit by. So cleverly did his remaining devotees contrive this secret crypt, that the attackers were never able to discover the resting place of the Black Pharaoh. Thus, the legend rests. According to common currency, the fable was handed down by the few remaining priests who actually stayed on the surface to seal the secret place. They and their descendants were believed to have perpetuated the story and the old faith of evil. Following this exceedingly unusual story, Carteret delved into the old tomes of the time. During a trip to London, he was fortunate enough to be allowed an inspection of the unhallowed and archaic Necronomicon of Abdul al-Hazred. In it, there were further emendations. One of his influential friends in the Home Office, hearing of his interest, managed to obtain for him a portion of Ludwig Brin's evil and blasphemous De Vermis Mysteriis, known more familiarly to students of recondite arcana as Mysteries of the Worm. Here, in that greatly disputed chapter on Oriental myth entitled Saracenic Rituals, Carteret found still more concrete elaborations of the Nefrenkar tale. Prynne, who consulted with the medieval seers and prophets of Saracen times in Egypt, gave a good deal of prominence to the whispered hints of Alexandrian necromancers and adepts. They knew the story of Nefrenkar and alluded to him as the Black Pharaoh. Prynne's account of the pharaoh's death was much more elaborate. He claimed that the secret tomb lay directly beneath Cairo itself, and professed to believe that it had been opened and reached. He hinted at the cult survival mentioned in the popular tales, spoke of a renegade group of descendants whose priestly ancestors had interred the rest alive. They were said to perpetuate the evil faith and to act as guardians of the dead Nefrenkar and his buried brethren, lest some interloper discover and violate his resting place in the crypt. After the regular cycle of 7,000 years, the Black Pharaoh and his band would then arise once more and restore the dark glory of the ancient faith. The crypt itself, if Prynne is to be believed, was a most unusual place. Nefrenkar's servants and slaves had builded him a mighty sepulchre, and the burrows were filled with the rich treasure of his reign. All of the sacred images were there, and the jeweled books of esoteric wisdom reposed within. Most peculiarly did the account dwell on Nefrenkar's search for the truth and the power of prophecy. It was said that before he died down in the darkness, he conjured up the earthly image of Nyarlathotep in a final gigantic sacrifice, and that the god granted him his desires. Nefrenkar had stood before the image of the blind ape of truth and received the gift of divination over the gory bodies of 100 willing victims. Then, in nightmare manner, Prynne recounts that the entombed pharaoh wandered among his dead companions and inscribed on the twisted walls of his tomb the secrets of the future. In pictures and ideographs, he wrote the history of days to come, reveling in omniscient knowledge till the end. He scrawled the destinies of kings to come, painted the triumphs and the dooms of unborn empires. Then, as the blackness of death shrouded his sight, and palsy wrenched the brush from his fingers, he betook himself in peace to his sarcophagus, and there died. So said Ludwig Prynne, he that consorted with ancient seers. Nefrenkar lay in his buried burrows, guarded by the priestly cult that still survived on earth, and further protected by enchantments in his tomb below. He had fulfilled his desires at the end. He had known the truth, and written the law of the future on the nighted walls of his own catacomb. Carteret had read all this with conflicting emotions. How he would like to find that tomb, if it existed. What a sensation! It would revolutionize anthropology, ethnology. Of course, the legend had its absurd points. Carteret, for all his research, was not superstitious. He didn't believe the bogus balderdash about Nyarlathotep, the blind ape of truth, or the priestly cult. That part about the gift of prophecy was sheer drivel. Well, such things were commonplace. There were many savants who had attempted to prove that the pyramids, in their geometrical construction, were archaeological and architectural prophecies of days to come. With elaborate and convincing skill, they attempted to show that, symbolically interpreted, the great tombs held the key to history, that they allegorically foretold the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, the Great War. This, Carteret believed, was rubbish. And the utterly absurd notion that a dying fanatic had been gifted with prophetic power and scrawled the future history of the world on his tomb as a last gesture before his death. That was impossible to swallow. Nevertheless, despite his sceptical attitude, Captain Carteret wanted to find the tomb if it had existed. He had returned to Egypt with that intention and immediately set to work. So far, he had a number of clues and hints. If the machinery of his investigation did not collapse, it was now only a matter of days before he would discover the actual entrance to the spot itself. Then he intended to enlist proper governmental aid and make his discovery public to all. This much he now told the silent Arab, who had come out of the night with a strange proposal and a weird credential. The seal of the Black Pharaoh, Nefrenkar. When Carteret finished his summary, he glanced at the dark stranger in interrogation. "What next?" he asked.
"Follow me," said the other urbanely. "I shall lead you to the spot you seek."
"Now?" gasped Carteret. The other nodded. "But it's too sudden. I mean, the whole thing is like a dream. You come out of the night unbidden and unknown, show me the seal and graciously offer to grant me my desires. Why? It doesn't make sense."
"This makes sense," the grave Arab indicated the black seal. "Yes,
admitted Carteret. But how can I trust you? Why must I go now? Wouldn't it be wiser to wait and get the proper authorities behind us? Won't there be need of excavation? Aren't there necessary instruments to take? No. The other spread his palms upwards. Just come. Look here. Carteret's suspicion crystallized in his sharp tones. How do I know this isn't a trap? Why should you come to me this way? Who the devil are you? Patience, the man smiled. I shall explain all. I have listened to your accounts of the legend with great interest, and while your facts are clear, your own view of them is mistaken. The legend you have learned of is true, all of it. Neferenkar did write the future on the walls of his tomb when he died. He did possess the power of divination, and the priests who buried him formed a cult which did survive.
Yes?
Carteret was impressed despite himself. I am one of those priests. The words stabbed like swords in the white man's brain. Do not look so shocked. It is the truth. I am a descendant of the original cult of Neferenkar, one of these inner initiates who have kept the legend alive. I worship the power which the Black Pharaoh received, and I worship the god of Nyarlathotep, who accorded that power to him. To us believers, the most sacred truth lies in the hieroglyphs inscribed by the divinely gifted Pharaoh before he died. Throughout the ages, we guardian priests have watched history unfold, and always it has agreed with the ideographs on those tunneled walls. We believe. It is because of our belief that I have sought you out. For within the secret crypt of the Black Pharaoh, it is written upon the walls of the future that you shall descend there. Stunning silence.
Do you mean to say, Carteret gasped, that those pictures show me discovering the spot?
They do, assented the dark man slowly. That is why I came to you unbidden. You shall come with me and fulfill the prophecy tonight, as it is written.
Suppose I don't come, flashed Captain Carteret suddenly. What about your prophecy then?
The Arab smiled.
You'll come, he said. You know that.
Carteret realized that it was so. Nothing could keep him away from this amazing discovery. A thought struck him. If this wall really records the details of the future, he began, perhaps you can tell me a little bit about my own coming history. Will this discovery make me famous? Will I return again to the spot? Is it written that I am to bring the secret of Neferenkar to light?
The dark man looked grave. That I do not know, he admitted. I neglected to tell you something about the walls of truth. My ancestor, he who first descended into the secret spot after it had been sealed, he who first looked upon the work of prophecy, did a needful thing, deeming that such wisdom was not for lesser mortals. He piously covered the walls with concealing tapestry. Thus, none might look upon the future too far. As time passed, the tapestry was drawn back to keep pace with the actual events of history, and always they have coincided with the hieroglyphs. Through the ages, it has always been the duty of one priest to descend to the secret tomb each day and draw back the tapestry so as to reveal the events of the day that follows. Now, during my life, that is my mission. My fellows devote their time to the needful rites of worship in hidden places. I alone descend the concealed passage daily and draw back the curtain on the walls of truth. When I die, another will take my place. Understand me. The writing does not minutely concern every single event, merely those which affect the history and destiny of Egypt itself. Today, my friend, it was revealed that you should descend and enter into the place of your desire. What the morrow holds in store for you, I cannot say, until the curtain is drawn once more. Carteret sighed. I suppose that there is nothing else left for me but to go, then. His eagerness was ill-dissembled. The dark man observed this at once, and smiled cynically while he strode to the door. "Follow me," he commanded. To Captain Carteret, that walk through the moonlit streets of Cairo was blurred in chaotic dream. His guide led him into labyrinths of looming shadows. They wandered through the twisted native quarters and passed through a maze of unfamiliar alleys and thoroughfares. Carteret strode mechanically at the dark stranger's heels, his thoughts avid for the great triumph to come. He hardly noticed their passage through a dingy courtyard when his companion drew up before an ancient well and pressed a niche revealing the passage beneath. He followed him as a matter of course. From somewhere, the Arab had produced a flashlight. Its faint beam almost rebounded from the murk of the inky tunnel. Together, they descended 1,000 stairs into the ageless and eternal darkness that broods beneath. Like a blind man, Carteret stumbled down, down into the depths of 3,000 vanished years. The temple was entered, the subterranean temple tomb of Neferenkar. Through silver gates the priest passed, his dazed companion following behind. Carteret stood in a vast chamber, the niched walls of which were lined with sarcophagi. "They hold the mummies of the interred priests and servants," explained his guide. Strange were the mummy cases of Neferenkar's followers, not like those known to Egyptology. The carven covers bore no recognized conventional features, as was the usual custom. Instead, they presented the strange grinning countenances of demons and creatures of fable. Jeweled eyes stared mockingly from the black visages of gargoyles spawned in a sculptor's nightmare. From every side of the room those eyes shone through the shadows, unwinking, unchanging, omniscient in this little world of the dead. Carteret stirred uneasily. Emerald eyes of death, ruby eyes of malevolence, yellow orbs of mockery. Everywhere they confronted him. He was glad when his guide led him forward at last, so that the incongruous rays of the flashlight shone on the entrance beyond. A moment later his relief was dissipated by the sight of a new horror confronting him at the inner doorway. Two gigantic figures shambled there, guarding either side of the opening. Two monstrous troglodytic figures. Great gorillas they were, enormous apes carved in simian semblance from black stone. They faced the doorway, squatting on mighty haunches, their huge hairy arms upraised in menace. Their glittering faces were brutally alive. They grinned bare-fanged with idiotic glee. And they were blind, eyeless and blind. There was a terrible allegory in these figures which Carteret knew only too well. The blind apes were destiny personified, a hulking, mindless destiny whose sightless, stupid gropings trampled on the dreams of men and altered their lives by aimless flailings of purposeless paws. Thus did they control reality. These were the blind apes of truth, according to the ancient legend, the symbols of the old gods worshipped by Neferenkar. Carteret thought of the myths once more, and trembled.
If tales were true, Nefren Kaa had offered up that final mighty sacrifice upon the obscene laps of these evil idols, offered them up to Nyarlathotep and buried the dead in the mummy cases set here in the niches. Then he had gone on to his own sepulchre within. The guide proceeded stolidly past the looming figures. Carteret, dissembling his dismay, started to follow. For a moment his feet refused to cross the gruesome, guarded threshold into the room beyond. He stared upward to the eyeless, ogreish faces that leered down from dizzying heights, with the feeling that he walked in realms of sheer nightmare. But the huge arms beckoned him on. The unseeing faces were convulsed in a smile of mocking invitation. The legends were true. The tomb existed. Would it not be better to turn back now, seek sane aid, and return again to this spot? Besides, what unguessed terror might not lair in the realms beyond? What horror spawn in the sable shadows of Nefren Kaa's inner secret sepulchre? All reason urged him to call out to the strange priest and retreat to safety. But the voice of reason was but a hushed and awe-stricken whisper here in the brooding burrows of the past. This was a realm of ancient shadow, where an antique evil ruled. Here the incredible was real, and there was a potent fascination in fear itself. Carteret knew that he must go on. Curiosity, cupidity, the lust for concealed knowledge all impelled him, and the blind apes grinned their challenge or command. The priest entered the third chamber, and Carteret followed. Crossing the threshold, he plunged into an abyss of unreality. The room was lighted by braziers set in 1,000 stations. Their glow bathed the enormous burrow with fiery luminance. Captain Carteret, his head reeling from the heat and mephitic miasma of the place, was thus able to see the entire extent of this incredible cavern. Seemingly endless, a vast corridor stretched on a downward slant into the earth beyond. A vast corridor, utterly barren, save for the winking red braziers along the walls. Their flaming reflections cast grotesque shadows that glimmered with unnatural life. Carteret felt as though he was gazing on the entrance to Carnita, the mythical underworld of Egyptian lore. "Here we are," said his guide softly. The unexpected sound of a human voice was startling. For some reason, it frightened Carteret more than he cared to admit. He had fallen into a vague acceptance of these scenes as being part of a fantastic dream. Now, the concrete clarity of a spoken word only confirmed an eerie reality. Yes, here they were, in the spot of legend, the place known to Alhazred, Prynne, and all the dark delvers in unhallowed history. The tale of Nefren Kaa was true, and if so, what about the rest of this strange priest's statements? What about the walls of truth, on which the Black Pharaoh had recorded the future, had foretold Carteret's own advent on the secret spot? As if in answer to these inner whispers, the guard smiled.
"Come, Captain Carteret. Do you not wish to examine the walls more closely?"
The captain did not wish to examine the walls. Desperately he did not. For they, if in existence, would confirm the ghastly horror that gave them being. If they existed, it meant that the whole evil legend was real, that Nefren Kaa, Black Pharaoh of Egypt, had indeed sacrificed to the dread dark gods, and that they had answered his prayer. Captain Carteret did not greatly wish to believe in such utterly blasphemous abominations as Nyarlathotep. He sparred for time.
"Where is the tomb of Nefren Kaa himself?" he asked. "Where are the treasures and the ancient books?"
The guide extended a lean forefinger.
"At the end of this hall," he exclaimed.
Peering down the infinity of lighted walls, Carteret indeed fancied that his eyes could detect a dark blur of objects in the dim distance. "Let us go there," he said. The guide shrugged. He turned, and his feet moved over the velvet dust. Carteret followed as if drugged.
"The walls," he thought. "I must not look at the walls. The walls of truth. The black pharaoh sold his soul to Nyarlathotep and received the gift of prophecy. Before he died here, he wrote the future of Egypt on the walls. I must not look, lest I believe. I must not know."
Red light glittered on either side. Step after step, light after light. Glare, gloom, glare, gloom, glare. The lights beckoned, enticed, attracted. "Look at us," they commanded. "See, dare to see all." Carteret followed his silent conductor.
"Look!"
flashed the lights. Carteret's eyes grew glassy. His head throbbed. The gleaming of the lights was mesmeric. They hypnotized with their allure.
"Look!
Would this great hall never end? No, there were thousands of feet to go."
"Look!" challenged the leaping lights.
Red serpent eyes in the underground dark, eyes of tempters, bringers of black knowledge.
"Look! Wisdom! No!" winked the lights.
They flamed in Carteret's brain.
Why not look? It was so easy.
Why fear? Why? His dazed mind repeated the question. Each following flare of fire weakened the question. At last, Carteret looked. Mad minutes passed before he was able to speak. Then he mumbled in a voice audible only to himself.
"True," he whispered. "All true."
He stared at the towering wall to his left, limned in red radiance. It was an interminable Bayeux tapestry carved in stone. The drawing was crude, in black and white, but it frightened. This was no ordinary Egyptian picture writing. It was not in the fantastic symbolic style of ordinary hieroglyphics. That was the terrible part. Nefren Ka was a realist. His men looked like men. His buildings were buildings. There was nothing here but a representation of stark reality, and it was dreadful to see. For at the point where Carteret first summoned sufficient courage to gaze, he stared at an unmistakable tableau involving crusaders and Saracens. Crusaders of the 13th century. Yet Nefren Ka had been dust for nearly 2,000 years. The pictures were small, yet vivid and distinct. They seemed to flow along quite effortlessly on the wall, one scene blending into another as though they had been drawn in unbroken continuity. It was as though the artist had not stopped once during his work, as though he had untiringly proceeded to cover this gigantic hall in a single supernatural effort. That was it. A single supernatural effort. Carteret could not doubt. Rationalize all he would, it was impossible to believe that these drawings were trumped up by any group of artists. It was one man's work. And the unerring, horrid consistency of it. The calculated picturization of the most vital and important phases of Egyptian history could have been set down in such accurate order only by a historical authority or a prophet. Nefren Ka had been given the gift of prophecy. And so, as he ruminated in growing dread, Carteret and his guide proceeded. Now that he had looked, a Medusian fascination held the man's eyes to the wall. He walked with history tonight. History and red nightmare. Flaming figures leered from every side. He saw the rise of the Mamluk Empire, looked on the despots and the tyrants of the East. Not all of what he saw was familiar to Carteret, for history has its forgotten pages. Besides, the scenes changed and varied at almost every step, and it was quite confusing. There was one picture interspersed with an Alexandrian court motif which depicted a catacomb, evidently in some vaults beneath the city. Here were gathered a number of men in robes which bore a curious similarity to those of Carteret's present guide. They were conversing with a tall, white, bearded man, whose crudely drawn figures seemed to exude an uncanny aura of black and baleful power.
"Ludwig Brin," said the guide softly, noting Carteret's stare. "He mingled with our priests, you know."
For some reason, the depiction of this almost legendary seer stirred Carteret more deeply than any other hitherto revealed terror. The casual inclusion of the infamous sorcerer in the procession of actual history hinted at dire things. It was as though Carteret had read a prosaic biography of Satan in Who's Who. Nevertheless, with a sort of heartsick craving, his eyes continued to search the walls as they walked onwards to the still, indeterminate end of the long, red-illumined chamber in which Nephron Carr was interred. The guide, priest, now for Carteret no longer doubted, proceeded softly, but stole covert glances at the white man as he led the way. Captain Carteret walked through a dream. Only the walls were real now, the walls of truth. He saw the Othmans rise and flourish, looked on forgotten battles and unremembered kings. Often there recurred in the sequence a scene depicting the priests of Nephron Carr's own furtive cult. They were shown amidst the disquieting surroundings of catacombs and tombs, engaged in unsavory occupations and revolting pleasures. The camera film of time rolled on. Captain Carteret and his companion walked on. Still the walls told their story. There was one small division of the wall which portrayed the priests conducting a man in Elizabethan costume through what seemed to be a pyramid. It was eerie to see the gallant in his finery, pictured amidst the ruins of ancient Egypt. And it was very dreadful indeed to almost watch like an unseen observer when a stealthy priest knifed the Englishman in the back as he bent over a mummy case. What now impressed Carteret was the infinitude of detail in each picture fragment. The features of all the men were almost photographically exact. The drawing, while crude, was lifelike and realistic. Even the furniture and background of every scene were correct. There was no doubting the authenticity of it all, and no doubting of the veracity thereby implied. But what was worse, there was no doubting that this work could not have been done by any normal artist, however learned, unless he had seen it all. Nephron Carr had seen it all in prophetic vision after his sacrifice to Nyarlathotep. Carteret was looking at truths inspired by a demon. On and on, to the flaming fane of worship and death at the end of the hall. History progressed as he walked. Now he was looking at a period of Egyptian law that was almost contemporary. The figure of Napoleon appeared. The battle of Abu Qir. The massacre of the pyramids. The downfall of Mamluk horsemen. The entrance to Cairo. Once again, a catacomb with priests. And three figures, white men, in French military regalia of the period. The priests were leading them into a red room. The Frenchmen were surprised, overcome, slaughtered. It was vaguely familiar. Carteret was recalling what he knew of Napoleon's commission. He had appointed savants and scientists to investigate the tombs and pyramids of the land. The Rosetta Stone had been discovered and other things. Quite likely, The three men shown had blundered onto a mystery the priests of Nefrenkar had not wanted to have unveiled. Hence, they had been lured to death as the wall showed. It was quite familiar, but there was another familiarity which Carteret could not place. They moved on, and the years rushed by in panorama. The Turks, the English, Gordon, the plundering of the pyramids, the World War. And ever so often, a picture of the priests of Nefrenkar and a strange white man in some catacomb or vault. Always, the white man died. It was all familiar. Carteret looked up and saw that he and the priest were very near to the blackness at the end of the great fiery hall. Only 100 steps or so, in fact. The priest, face hidden in his burnous, was beckoning him on. Carteret looked at the wall. The pictures were almost ended. But no. Just ahead was a great curtain of crimson velvet on a ceiling rack which ran off into the blackness and reappeared from shadows on the opposite side of the room to cover that wall. "The future," explained his guide. And Captain Carteret remembered that the priest had told how each day he drew back the curtain a bit so that the future was always revealed just one day ahead. He remembered something else, and hastily glanced at the last visible section of the wall of truth next to the curtain. He gasped. It was true. Almost as though gazing into a miniature mirror, he found himself staring into his own face. Line for line, feature for feature, posture for posture, he and the priest of Nefrenkar were shown standing together in this red chamber, just as they were now. The red chamber. Familiarity. The Elizabethan man with the priest of Nefrenkar were in a catacomb when the man was murdered. The French scientists were in a red chamber when they died. Other later Egyptologists had been shown in a red chamber with the priests, and they, too, had been slain. The red chamber. Not familiarity, but similarity. They had been in this chamber. And now he stood here with a priest of Nefrenkar. The others had died because they had known too much. Too much about what? Nefrenkar? A terrible suspicion began to formulate into hideous reality. The priests of Nefrenkar protected their own. This tomb of their dead leaders was also their fane, their temple. When intruders stumbled onto the secret, they lured them down here and killed them lest others learn too much. Had not he come in the same way? The priest stood silent as he gazed at the wall of truth.
"Midnight," he said softly. "I must draw back the curtain to reveal yet another day before we go. You expressed a wish, Captain Carteret, to see what the future holds in store for you. Now, that wish shall be granted."
With a sweeping gesture, he flung the curtain back along the wall for a foot. Then he moved swiftly. One hand leapt from the burnous. A gleaming knife flashed through the air, drawing red fire from the lamps, then sank into Carteret's back, drawing redder blood. With a single groan, the white man fell. In his eyes there was a look of supreme horror, not born of death alone. For as he fell, Captain Carteret read his future in the walls of truth, and it confirmed a madness that could not be. As Captain Carteret died, he looked at the picture of his next hours of existence and saw himself being knifed by the priest of Nefrenkar. The priest vanished from the silent tomb, just as the last flicker of dying eyes showed to Carteret the picture of a still white body. His body, lying in death before the wall of truth.
You just heard The Fane of the Black Pharaoh by Robert Bloch, read by Nick Cam. And that, my friends, is what happens when you combine a master storyteller and a skilled vocal performer. And please forgive me as I gush a bit about the awesomeness of what you just heard. There aren't many authors who could pull off what Bloch did with this story. I mean, consider the sequence of events. A man is given a rare artifact, is persuaded to follow the giver of the artifact into a lost temple. He sees some amazing stuff, and then he's killed. Bam. Now, if I were an editor hearing that as a story pitch, I'd probably give it a pass. But Bloch seduces you, lures you into the mind of the protagonist, shares the excitement and the wonder as each layer of the mystery is slowly peeled away, only to plunge a knife in your back. The hero's back, I mean, at the end. And the thing is, you know it's not going to end well for our hero. As soon as the word Necronomicon is put on the table, it's no longer a question of, will this be a happy ending? But rather, how messed up is the hero going to be at the end? And I gotta ask, were any of you shouting, yes, it looks familiar, it looks real familiar, do you see a pattern? Get out of there! At whatever device you were listening with? Yeah, me too. It was interesting, though. After the second time Carteret had that feeling, and you knew what was behind that last curtain, were you still rooting for him? I mean, we're still hoping he can somehow escape the doom we know is awaiting him. But that hope got a little thin at that point, right? Now, normally at that point, I'd disconnect emotionally, as I think most readers would, and just observe as the inevitable sequence of events unfolded. But that didn't happen for me. And this is, I think, one of the compelling arguments for audio fiction. I mean, Nick's narration was so rich and evocative that I felt my perspective shift. Even though the point of view of the story hadn't changed, it was like I was experiencing it as if I were the priest drinking in the final thoughts of my victim. It was kind of creepy. Which, I suppose, is the idea, right? Now, I'd be curious to know if any of you experienced that weird shift, too. Go ahead and leave a comment on the post if you're so inclined. The other thing that Bloch handles so elegantly is backstory. In the writing world, we call it an info dump, when the writer gives you all the history and background they think you need to understand what's going on. And technically, the first third of that story was one big info dump. Now, for a writer, this is usually the kiss of death when the reader starts wondering if this is a story or a history lesson. But Bloch pulls it off. Like the host of a banquet, he uncovers each course of historical background like a master chef, garnishing each one with passions and desires that transform them from mere information into an unfolding saga that you just can't put down. I loves me a good pulp fiction feast, don't you? Now, before we wrap up, let me give you a couple quick reminders. The first being that the marvelously terrifying tales from our sister podcast, Tales to Terrify, have been bound into a single tome of doom. This relic of evil, Tales to Terrify Volume 1, is currently available as a hardback, paperback, or ebook. Whether you covet this dark compilation for yourself or want to share the terror with a loved one, it is filled to the brim with tales you've heard and some you haven't, by the authors that have distinguished Tales to Terrify as one of the premier horror podcasts. And for the literarily ambitious among our listenership, there are the video seminars and workshops available through Starship Sofa to consider. These videos are exceptional tools with which to hone your craft, whether you're a narrator, screenwriter, or author. Swing by the Starship Sofa website at www.starshipsofa.com and check out the selection. Now, each week, the fell and dire priests of the dark god that is protecting Project Pulp labor tirelessly, offering up grim sacrifices to the ever-hungry deity so that we can bring you a fabulous pulp fiction tale each week. Our assistant editor is Fred Heimbaugh, who, draped in the black robes of his office, wanders the shadowy recesses of the literary metropolis, ravenous for the pristine pages of superb pulp tales. Our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, makes his home in the echoing vaults and catacombs amid the harmonious treasures of audio fiction, shining and polishing each jewel to the height of its dark radiance. And our editor and producer is Tony Smith, high priest of our dark faith, driven mad by the whisperings of 100,000 stories, until at last he sold his soul to the merciless deity of fabulous fiction. We hope you enjoyed today's story. And remember, if some shady priest sidles up to you and offers you the precious artifact of a great pulp story, and all you have to do is follow him into a dark temple to claim it, just politely decline and tell them you get all your fabulous pulp stories by subscribing to Protecting Project Pulp on iTunes. And, you know, you can also secure your weekly shipment of pulpy awesomeness at our website, www.protectingprojectpulp.com. Next week, we have an action-packed airborne adventure for you by Cyril Plunkett, titled The X-Gas. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Robison, wishing you nothing but the finest adventures. I'll see you next week. This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.